Coming up on The Green, from Delaware Public Media, children's museums, which rely heavily on a hands-on experience, have struggled during the COVID-19 pandemic. That includes the Delaware Children's Museum in Wilmington.
Our unofficial mission statement is happy to be scrappy. So we are a scrappy museum. We are very resourceful.
We chat with Delaware Children's Museum Executive Director Jen Bush. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about an initiative expanding across the state that seeks to light the way to safer communities. Arts Playlist tells us about a collaboration between Winterthur and the Choir School of Delaware. And Enlighten Me introduces us to a Joe Biden-themed craft beer. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Relying so heavily on a hands-on experience, many children's museums around the country have struggled throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, and some have even had to close their doors permanently. Here in the First State, the Delaware Children's Museum on the Wilmington Riverfront has stayed closed since March, missing out on celebrating its 10th anniversary back in April. This week, Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia chats with the museum's executive director, Jen Bush, about how it's handling the pandemic and how COVID could change the way it operates once it reopens.
First, tell me a little bit about, how the Children's Museum has been handling during this pandemic. Obviously, children can't really be coming into the museum right now. What have you guys been doing? How have things been for you guys?
We like to say that while the building is closed, our mission continues. And while our doors are closed, our hearts and minds continue to remain open. And we have been doing quite a bit virtually. So the museum doors closed on Friday the 13th, March the 13th. We'll never forget that day. And they have remained, our building has remained closed. But like many children's museums and many museums in general, we did the big pivot, that was the word everybody used, and really took a lot of our programming that typically is hands-on, open-ended, child-directed, and really changed that and put that online. And we've done that, that's all been free as well. So we have a pretty big social media impressions, and our social media posts are almost daily.
So a lot of bringing the Children's Museum into people's homes.
Yes, we love to say that. We love to say that. We don't want the mission, even when we were open, we never wanted the mission to stay within the museum walls. The goal was always for the mission to go back home, or go back to the classroom, or go back into the community. So now more than ever, it's good that we always had that mindset, because it just allowed that to be magnified, once the pandemic and all the restrictions hit. So we were doing that even before pandemic.
In children's museums, I know in the Delaware Children's Museum, there are a lot of, sort of hands-on activities that children are doing. Children are playing with each other all the time. Obviously, we know that a lot of children can be messy kids. Has there been a plan that you guys have been developing in terms of what's going to happen to the museum post-COVID? Are things going to change in terms of how children are interacting in the museum and how people are going to be playing in this museum?
Safety and cleanliness will always be top priority at the Delaware Children's Museum. That was pre-pandemic, will be post-pandemic. We always like to say you can never be too safe or too clean. And that's just because that's our audience, right? You need to make sure that the adults that are coming, that are making decisions to come to the museum, you always want them to be able to say yes, right? That it's clean and safe. And if it's not safe and clean, then they're not going to want to come back, no matter how much they learn or make a memory or have a good time. So we learned that a long time ago. And so that's always been paramount. I can't stress that enough. We've always been very stringent on cleaning and sanitizing, so sanitizing all the props on a daily basis. I think we're also a learning institution, and as a learning institution, we want to learn from the scientists and the doctors and the people that this is their vocation and training. So we're also learning from them and listening to them and listening to their recommendations. So I think as scientists and doctors learn more about the virus, we're learning more about how best we can keep guests and staff safe. And that seems to be evolving over time. So our response has been evolving over time as well. And I believe that once we reopen, we will be the safest and, you know, that we possibly know how to be. You know, we listen to the governor's guidelines, you know, every week. We are in touch with Association of Children's Museums. There's a weekly call with other executive directors on a weekly basis that I listen to. So we're learning from one another, because certainly, I'm sure as you have researched, there's some children's museums that have reopened and some that have stayed closed, depending on, you know, their state and their city and their region. So we've learned from one another, and we've shared about what's working, you know, so I know what's working and from some children's museums that have, you know, reopened. You know, a lot of the staggering of times, right? That's what a lot of children's museums are doing. And, you know, depending on when the Delaware Children's Museum reopens, will depend on if we have to do the staggered times and hours, or is it going to be post-vaccination is when we reopen. So I think that's going to depend, you know, when we talk about the moving target, we're just not real sure yet.
Lastly, I mean, obviously, since you mentioned that we don't really know a reopening date and things are kind of a moving target right now, I mean, how are you guys doing? I haven't really learned how you guys are doing. I know that a lot of children's museums are kind of struggling financially. I've seen a couple of children's museums closing, or museums in general, just because they couldn't afford to stay closed for so long. How long can you guys, you know, afford to stay closed into the future until, you know, we actually get a reopening date?
Yes. You know, I think that's something that, you know, museums, children's museums, we've all been, you know, there's been lots of interesting discussions. Certainly children's museums and certainly the Delaware Children's Museum, we were so proud. We really depend on our earned revenue versus contributed revenue. We're about a 65-35 split, so 65 earned revenue, 35 contributed revenue. And a lot of that earned revenue certainly was admissions. We had over 140,000 guests come through our doors last year. It's admissions, birthday parties, field trips, museum rentals, our retail store. Everything was up. We were doing phenomenal. When I tell you, Roman, we were phenomenal. And, you know, then the pandemic hit and we had to have all sorts of different conversations. So, you know, right now we still have our 6 full-time staff. So we are a scrappy museum. We are very resourceful. And we've really learned that in the last 5 years. Just the importance of being safe, clean. How are we really utilizing staff and any of the resources the best way that we know how. We did a whole exhibit out of cardboard boxes. You know, we have a cardboard box maze. So we're very resourceful pre-pandemic, and we expect to be the same post-pandemic. I think that mindset has really helped get us through. We're depending on that mindset to help get us through this time. The really great thing about Delaware Children's Museum is being in Delaware. And Delaware has definitely wrapped, Delawareans love their children's museum and see it as a resource and, you know, want their children's museum to succeed. And so do our elected officials. And I mean, we just had a tremendous support. So does our museum community and arts and culture community. They have been incredibly supportive, whether it's the Delaware Museum of Natural History. We've been going there on Saturdays to engage and keep the Children's Museum mission alive at the Delaware Museum of Natural History. So we're incredibly grateful to Halsey and all the great folks there. We just have a great support system in our arts and culture and nonprofit community in Delaware, and we expect, you know, to reopen and keep on playing. We miss children and families. I do personally. It's sad.
Well, great. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, and good luck to all the, you know, our fellow museums and children's museums. We're a strong, creative, thoughtful group, and, you know, I believe in the power of and the importance of children's museums and our field, and I'm very proud of the field and all the people that work in it.
Thanks to the Delaware Children's Museum's Executive Director, Jen Bush, and our Roma Battalion for their time on The Green this week. And stay with us. The Green continues with more on a relatively small initiative that's having a fairly big impact, helping communities statewide light the way to safer neighborhoods. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. An initiative to shine a light on neighborhoods in need and help them diminish crime and build a sense of community is making progress up and down the First State. It's called Lights On and comes from a group called the Delaware Help Initiative. Contributor Larry Nagengast takes a closer look at this group and what it's doing in his latest piece available at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to detail what he learned. So let's start with the Delaware Help Initiative. What's its mission? Who are its leaders?
Well, the Delaware Help Initiative is a fairly new nonprofit organization. It was created 4 years ago. It's based in Dover. And its mission is to improve the health and safety of low-income individuals and their families by showing and providing them with healthy home best practices so that they can keep their utilities bills manageable and maintain a good quality of life. The founders and the key staff members of this nonprofit are Harold Stafford, who was once Delaware Secretary of Labor, and Charles Kistler, who has spent about 30 years managing complex government-funded projects, primarily in the information technology and physical security areas.
And the project that they're doing that you focused on is the Lights On Initiative. It's something they've been working on for a few years. Tell us a little bit about what that is and how did it get started?
Well, Lights On got started 3 years ago in early 2017, and it's part of the Reviving Central Dover Community Revitalization Project. That effort had many pieces, including the nonprofits Habitat for Humanity and NCAL. We're building and rehabilitating more than 20 houses in the Dover area, and there are various other economic development revitalization pieces as well. Anyhow, Kistler and Stafford went to one of the committee meetings for the project, and they learned that one of the issues that concerned the people in Dover was this high incidence of crime in poorly lit neighborhoods. So they pitched the idea that they developed to Mayor Robin Christensen. The idea here is really pretty simple. You go replace the old incandescent bulbs on their front porches with energy efficient LED lights, and then in the back of the homes install solar powered motion detectors. The goal here: better lighting, improved safety, and at a very low cost to residents. And they wound up doing installations in about 350 houses in central Dover, in the area just north of the downtown business district.
And your story notes that Lights On kind of relies on community buy-in. What do residents need to commit to as part of this? And your piece suggests that initially it might have been the easiest thing to get people on board right away, right?
Well, as with many free offers, there is usually a string attached, and I mean this one's a pretty simple string. In return for receiving the LED bulbs and the motion detectors, the residents had to agree that they would keep these lights on at night, and that they would tell their neighbors about the project, and if they noticed any suspicious activity in their neighborhood, in their yard, whatever, that they would call the police. Now, there was, of course, some hesitation at the start. Certainly in any number of low-income communities in various parts of the state, you do have people who are suspicious of calling the police and cooperating with the police and so on. So, there was a little bit of hesitation at the start, but it took a couple of weeks and residents realized what was going on. They saw that the Lights On team was really interested in improving their neighborhood. And after a while, the residents would start coming up to the work crews and they would ask the work crews, when are they going to get around to putting in the LED lights on my block? It took a while, but once they became familiar with the project, it really started to take off.
Well, you kind of alluded to it just there, that the program has expanded well beyond Dover now. Where has it been added over time, and what have some of those projects looked like?
In Seaford, the people in Seaford, the city council and so on, heard about what was going on in Dover, and they invited the HELP Initiative to set up a Lights On program there. And they installed something like 450 sets of lights and motion detectors in homes and 450 homes on the city's west side. After that, the momentum would build a little bit more, and there were similar campaigns in Milford and then Laurel and then Georgetown. Last fall, the project moved north and started work on Wilmington's west side September, October of last year, but the COVID-19 pandemic brought that to a halt in March. Work there on Wilmington's west side resumed this week. Meanwhile, the HELP Initiative, with support from the Newcastle County Police, has installed LED lights and motion detectors in both Edgemore Gardens and Knollwood, two communities in Brandywine Hundred that have experienced some crime problems in recent years, and in Knollwood's case, going back a good many years.
So what's some of the feedback the program has gotten from these various places where it's been put in place?
Well, the people who have received the LED lights and the motion detectors are happy, and so are the officials in the cities and the towns that have been served. Lighting improves the appearance of the community, residents feel safer, and they're also reaping the benefits of lower utility bills. Might also mention, when I talked to Robin Christensen, the Dover mayor, he points out that by improving these communities, it does a lot of other things and has a snowball effect, making the community safer, makes Dover look better overall, and that helps him and the rest of the city government when they're pitching the city as a site for new businesses to locate as well.
So part of this, obviously, we've talked about is making communities safer. Is there any solid data on if it's achieving that goal of reducing crime in these neighborhoods, in these municipalities?
Yes, there is. I did talk to an officer in the Milford Police Department, which was one of the first places where they did some tracking, where they did some crime maps and overlays of the areas that were targeted for the lighting installations. And the Milford police officer offered me some numbers that showed that the incidence of some crimes had dropped in the targeted neighborhoods over the last 3 years. Now, of course, we are talking about a relatively small sample size here, and in a with the COVID-19 during 2020, people's lifestyles and habits have changed a little bit, so it becomes a little bit difficult to take the data that's available and make strong conclusions from it. But The Milford officer did make a couple of interesting points. Thefts and incidents of criminal mischief are down, which would indicate that the lighting has some sort of some deterrent effect. In addition to that, people are getting more calls about suspicious activities and more reports about missing property being found. Again, this is something that can be attributed to the fact that there is better lighting in the community. Now, Dover's mayor did tell me that crime there hasn't dropped nearly as much as they had hoped, but still, conditions overall have improved enough for the city that they consider the project a success. On Wilmington's west side, there's no data yet, but the community leaders that I spoke to say that the residents do feel more secure and that they are also showing more pride in their neighborhoods.
So let's talk a little bit more about Wilmington's west side that you just mentioned. The program is wrapping up its COVID-delayed work there. Your piece suggests that it fits in with some other things that are being done on the west side of Wilmington. How does Lights On fit in with the overall effort to address crime and security and safety there?
Well, there, again, about 7 years ago, there was a coalition of organizations that formed a revitalization plan that's known as West Side Grows Together. And there have been a lot of improvements in the area as a result of this revitalization project. We've had new traffic patterns on Union Street, new facades on the businesses on Union Streets and on Union Street and Lincoln Street. Several parks have been upgraded, a few more are planned. There have been a number of mural projects as well in the area. Lights On helps meet another need, and you know, we talked about this in the other communities here, improving lighting. And for Lights On, they focused in the area around Judy Johnson Park, which is near 3rd and DuPont Streets. And the lighting project stretched onto 4th Street as well. And 4th Street, as many people know, is a main artery leading into and out of Wilmington's downtown district. On 4th Street, there's also been a separate program that has involved installation of security cameras on about 25 businesses on 4th Street on the west side. That combination of lights and cameras is something that's going to translate into more safety, better security for both residents and business owners in that 4th Street corridor.
Your piece also notes that the HELP initiative offers more than just these lights and motion detectors. What else do they provide to the neighborhoods they're working in?
Okay, well, they do a lot of little things, some of them on the inside of homes. For example, they will replace the aerators that are on the kitchen and bathroom faucets, and with the new aerators make it possible to use a little bit less water. And so that's help save on water bills. They also install water-saving shower heads. They check the heat settings on water heaters as well to make sure that you've got it set at the proper temperature, that it's not too hot, and to make sure that the heaters are operating efficiently. If residents want some of these LED lights to go in their lamps, their indoor fixtures, they'll provide them as well. HELP Initiative also has a subcontractor that will do free energy audits, and the program will help residents find contractors to make any repairs that are recommended through these audits and assist them in securing loans and grants to make those improvements. So it's become a multifaceted project that works in depth to help low-income families make their homes safer and more efficient.
So you mentioned money. I'm curious about the funding for this. How do they make this happen financially?
Okay, well, you know, the cost per home isn't all that great when you think about it. They estimate that installing the motion detectors and the LED lights and, you know, the aerators and so on costs about $100 per home. So it's not a big expense when, you know, they're getting these supplies at bulk pricing. Now, sometimes the cities where the installations occur have funding available through grants or through their own budgets, but most of the funding comes through another Delaware profit, Energize Delaware, which in turn gets most of its money through something called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. I'm not going to get into all the details of, you know, how that works, but in any case, there's a nice flow of funding there that that will keep this project going. For some of the bigger projects, things that might be identified through the energy audits, things like if a home needs insulation or if it needs repairing or replacing a heating system, several state agencies have grant programs that tap into federal funding that can reduce the cost of those improvements as well.
So let's wrap up by asking this. The work of the HELP Initiative looks like it's a pretty good example of how doing some little things can have a bigger impact. What's next for the organization?
The HELP Initiative leadership seems more than willing to try to help other communities that reach out to them. And now this addition of these other services, these repairs and improvements that have been identified through the energy audits, show that the organization also wants to increase and intensify its impact. Now, whether it's working on more communities or working more intensely in the areas that it's already serving, there's one thing that I think we can be pretty sure about. So many families are hurting because of the pandemic, and many of these government supports that were created earlier this year are expected to expire in the next month or so. So I think it's pretty safe to say that there are going to be plenty of opportunities for the HELP Initiative to extend its helping hand.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time on The Green this week. His piece on the Delaware HELP Initiative and its Lights On program is available at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with Arts Playlist, where we learn about a new collaboration between Winterthur and the Choir School of Delaware. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Winterthur Museum, Garden and Library, and the Choir School of Delaware are launching a new partnership. The Choir School will serve as Winterthur's artists in residence for the winter 2020 and spring 2021 seasons. Ariane Harley Emerson and Brittany Stanton work for the Choir School. Harley Emerson is the Director of Music and Operations, while Stanton is Director of Education and an Assistant Conductor. They joined Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele on this week's Arts Playlist to talk about this new collaboration, which includes a series of Choir School of Delaware concerts during Winterthur's Yuletide House Tours in December and another performance in April 2021.
Hey, Ariane, I'm going to start with you. Before we talk about this collaboration here, this partnership, talk about the Choir School of Delaware a little bit.
Sure, happy to. So I always like to say that the Choir School is one of Wilmington's best-kept secrets, and we're trying to make sure that it is no longer a secret. We were actually founded in 1883 at the Cathedral Church of St. John downtown, right at the corner of Concord and Market. And since then, we have been an intergenerational choir. Of course, then the choir looked a bit different. It was the choir of men and boys at that time. And they sang for, of course, all of the liturgies at the cathedral. So we essentially sang as the choir of men and boys for almost 100 years before it actually became a co-ed program. And then in the 90s, as the neighborhood began to change, there wasn't much green space that was really left in the Brandywine Village. And so the neighborhood kids were playing on what was the Great Lawn, and occasionally a stone would go through the window and such. And the dean of the cathedral at that time and the music director at that time decided, instead of, trying to tell folks to get off the property, to invite them in. And that's really the genesis of this iteration and this evolution of the choir school. And at that point, the choir began to open up. Yes, it was for boys, it was for girls, but the demographics of the program began to change. Instead of being an affluent population, it was really a population from the neighborhood, which really is predominantly now brown and black, predominantly families who are facing a significant amount of barriers to their success. And so now our program, in addition to singing, also offers academic support, one-on-one mentoring, and a robust offering of life skills and other critical social services. Our goal is to launch kids not into necessarily a music career, but to launch them into their lives. And so that we're proud that we have a 100% high school graduation rate and that all of our students continue on to higher education, whether that be in college or university, which is the vast majority, or in the military, armed forces, or perhaps trade and technical schools. So really, we serve as a community center that sings, providing critical social services along with the superior music education.
Ariane, how many youth would you say come through your doors on a monthly, yearly basis? How many people do you serve?
Sure, yeah. In a year that's not a year where everything is shut down and, you know, you're kind of reduced with your capacity, we serve about 40 children over the course of a year in after-school programming, and we'll serve about another 50 approximately during our summer camp program, which runs for 5 weeks in the summer.
All right, Brittany, I want to get some information from you because now the Choir School of Delaware has launched this partnership, this collaboration, if you will, with Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library. And we're talking about the Choir School of Delaware presenting a series of concerts during the Winterthur Yuletide House Tours in December, followed by a concert celebrating fables, fairy tales, even nursery rhymes. Next April, in April of 2021. So talk to me about what's happening in December first, and then we'll talk about next year's program.
So this year we have a program that is, it's our first hybrid concert that we are presenting. So the choir in its fullness will be presented virtually, and then there will be a few in-person singers to add to the merrymaking, some small group singing during that time. It's a beautiful concert with pieces that represent various holidays throughout the season and a wide range of repertoire. But the core piece is A Dickens Christmas by Stephen McNeff, and it is a suite of pieces based on some text from Dickens and some other authors at that time. And it is a beautiful holiday celebration. And we're tying in that literacy piece into our programming so that kids are learning about A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens as well. This presentation is going to be part of the Yuletide Tour, and so there'll be multiple opportunities to see this concert, and we'll also be streaming it at 4 p.m. that day.
I like the educational portion of that. I mean, A Dickens Christmas, who hasn't heard of A Dickens Christmas, right?
Right. It's a tradition for this time of year.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Brittany, talk to me about fables, folklore, and fairy tales. Now, this isn't happening until, I believe, April 25th of 2021, but we want to make people aware of it now. What's this all about?
So this is actually going to be an outdoor concert in April at Winterthur, and all of the pieces are based on, again, pieces of literature on fairy tales, fables, folklore, nursery rhymes. And we're very excited about the opportunity to perform outside. You know, Winterthur has that beautiful fairy garden, and being together is also of something we very much look forward to be able to perform outside together, I think is going to be a really wonderful, beautiful experience. And then, of course, as part of our literacy initiative, whenever we get to the spring months, the students will be taking a look at what makes a fairy tale, what is a fable, why are fables important, things like that will be incorporated into our programming.
Brittany, as the Director of Education and as Assistant Conductor of the Choir School of Delaware, what has your experiences been over the years working with these youth?
I have been with the choir school since June 2019, and it has been an absolute pleasure to watch the children grow and learn. I am blown away every day by the caliber of music that they are able to learn and produce, and to see them working with the adults side by side, whether it's in the after-school program with their mentor or tutor, or if it's with a singing mentor in the choir. It's just a really amazing thing to see them working side by side with the adults, guiding them along the way, and how much they're able to learn. And whenever you come to one of our concerts, whether it's in person or virtual, you'll be able to see this because the children are are dispersed throughout the choir, standing aside the adults. And it's just, it's truly a unique experience that you don't see very many intergenerational choirs. And so I strongly encourage you, if you haven't seen the Choir School of Delaware, make sure that you check out this upcoming concert in December.
I love this partnership. We've been talking to Ariane Harley Emerson and Brittany Stanton, both with the Choir School of Delaware. In case you haven't heard, Winterterm Museum, Garden and Library, and the Choir School of Delaware, which is an out-of-school time music and academic enrichment program serving some of Wilmington's most vulnerable youth, are announcing that the Choir School will serve as Winterter's Artist in Residence during the winter of 2020 and the spring of 2021 seasons. Ariane, I'm going to give the final words to you. I'm sure we're going to be practicing safety precautions because of COVID, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Including social distancing, masks, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. So we have been very, very meticulous in our planning, and our partners at Wintertour are always very careful and meticulous and thoughtful about their planning as well. And so we have created an experience that will meet everyone's comfort level, whether you are saying, you know what, I need to stay at home, not a problem. You can stream the concert from home at 4 o'clock. And if you're feeling like, I want to come out, I want to see the house tour. Everyone knows that this is one of the best, you know, area local traditions up there with going to see Longwood Gardens is, of course, coming to see the house at Winter Tour in all of its glory. There will be timed entrances as there are for every year, but the capacity is much reduced. Requirements for wearing masks. Of course, there will be temperatures taken, other symptoms screened. All of that will be in effect to make sure that everyone is safe. As far as the performance itself, the performance is being, the choir will perform at 11, 12, 1 o'clock, and 2 o'clock. And why we've done that is so that we can accommodate small groups and to have audiences that are very small throughout that day so that everyone can be masked, socially distanced in Copeland Hall, and that we are able to even cycle air between the various concerts. The choir will be singing, but again, it's only a few members of the choir will be singing. They'll be wearing special singer's masks that give them a little bit more flexibility to be able to sing and to articulate while still keeping themselves and, of course, all of the audience members safe as well. So we've definitely been very thoughtful about the process. We will absolutely be keeping everyone safe. And then we'll also be bringing a lot of holiday cheer and a much needed merriment through this time of year when there are so few things that we can do safely. We're happy to be able to present this opportunity, this concert, and the house tour, of course.
Ariane, I know I said I was going to give you the last words, but I thought of something. I don't know if, Brittany, you want to take this, maybe Ariane. Has this kind of partnership ever been done before between Winterter and the Choir School of Delaware?
I'll take that. Yes. How this actually came to be, Carol Cadieu is the executive director of Winterter, and she is still, I would say, relatively new. She's been there about 2 years at this point. But when she first came into town, we met at an event for executive directors of nonprofits, and we started talking about, you know, Winterthur, the choir school, how they were both steeped in this DuPont history and this really rich history, and that we should totally do something together. And so last year, we did a concert at Winterthur called A Royal Affair. It was when Winterthur was doing their costuming, the Crown exhibit. And so the choir sang some songs from the soundtrack of The Crown, as well as other pieces that were commissioned by the British monarchy. We had a composer that came and did a lecture who was a chorister at the Choir School of Westminster Abbey. His name is Philip Stopford. And the concert was a success. It was sold out. It was standing room only. And we thought, man, this is something special. We got to do this again. And so we decided that we would be doing something. We didn't really know what it would be. And then with COVID hitting and the students missing so much time from school, we thought, man, this is a real opportunity to have a literary focus to the year, to have this intervention for reading, and to be able to combine it with music as well. And so that is what really sprung forth this season and this partnership and this artist in residency program. So we're excited to be doing this.
Thanks to the Choir School of Delaware's Ariane Harley Emerson and Brittany Stanton, as well as our Kelly Steele, for joining us on Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me and more on a local craft brewery's tribute to President-elect Joe Biden that's about to debut. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Wilmington Brewworks is coming out with a new beer to commemorate the first president of the United States ever to be elected from the state of Delaware. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Nick Schlino speaks with John Fusco, the vice president and creative and brand marketer at Wilmington Brewworks, about this new IPA and the adjustments the brewery has made during the pandemic.
Start by telling me the marketing scheme around this new Railcar One beer.
So, around the Saturday after the election that it seemed like Joe Biden was going to pull it off and be president-elect, there was just a buzz around Wilmington, and it was really fun. A lot of people were going down to the riverfront and seeing everything that was going on, and, I had mentioned at one point to my partners that, I wonder if there's a what the history is between presidential train cars. Like, there was a Air Force One since, Biden took the train so much. And I started sketching something out. And the next thing I knew, I had a drawing of a basically an Amtrak car with a Air Force One paint job. And originally we were going to call it Amtrak One. We kind of figured we might get into some copyright issues with that. So I did some research into, the history of those presidential train cars, and Railcar One is a little bit of something that Roosevelt used. So we kind of figured that might be a fun name for it.
Yeah, that's very cool. One potential concern, I mean, you mentioned the buzz in Wilmington when Biden became president-elect, and this is his home state, and certainly a blue state. Do you worry at all that there's any sort of partisanship in this beverage?
We try and say that beer is not partisan. Beer is one thing that can help really bring people together. And I think that we said that on the can itself. And you said, even though number 46 doesn't engage in the occasional tipple, his fine friends in the first state certainly do, and that's something we can all agree on. This is really more about some local pride and not anything partisan.
All right, tell me about the beer. What's it taste like?
So the beer is a Northeast IPA. We're calling it a double Delaware IPA because we are using our in-house wild yeast strain, which kind of is unique to our brewery, and we think it gives it a really nice flavor. It uses Mosaic, Citra, and Sultana hops, and it's about 8% alcohol by volume.
And how have things been for you, both from the marketing standpoint and just business in general during the pandemic?
So I think I would say that we've been very lucky during the pandemic. We have a really great community around us and a lot of supporters that have really come out to help us during the pandemic. When it first started back in March, we kind of saw the writing on the wall that this was coming, and spent the full weekend before the shutdown building out a website so that we could take online orders. And we quickly pivoted to online orders for pickup, which our customers and fan base really latched onto, to the point where it's something that's going to stay, whenever this ends. People can go onto our website. They order crowlers and growlers for pickup. They order, cans and bottles that we have in the tap room, whatever is available that day. And then they come pick them up with either curbside pickup or come on into the tap room, get a growler filled, and leave. It's been really great. Since we moved to, starting in phase one in June, and in phase two later on with the occupancy restrictions, we really extended our outdoor seating. We had some great outdoor patios to begin with, but we've really taken advantage of those outdoor seatings, and people are really enjoying that. We have heaters up and down our building. Our normal tap room is known as being a large, bustling Oktoberfest-style room, just long tables. You can meet all kinds of people, and we certainly miss that. We're doing table service now as required. We can't wait to get back to that that old style, but a lot of people are really enjoying the table service right now, and it's working out well for us.
Yeah, it sounds like you're in good spirits about it, and I would think that picking up beer, it's something people do at the liquor store. You'd think it'd be pretty popular at a local brewery with, locally made beers. Has that been the case?
Absolutely. You know, there's something about getting something that's fresh. You know, everything that we do, we barely have enough room to keep anything in stock. We are constantly making new beers and pumping it out, and our fan base really appreciates that. We can always put something new out. Our brewer and president CEO, Craig Wenzel, is a bit of a mad scientist back there, always tinkering with something. And me, as the marketing guy and the guy has to draw a logo for all these beers, I'm constantly back in my heels with, okay, looks like we're creating another new beer and I need to make another new label. But it's a good problem to have.
All right, so when does the new Railcar One come out? When can people get it?
So we're going to drop it on Delaware Day, December 7th. We thought that was appropriate. We will be canning it, if not that morning, then the night before. And as soon as it is ready to be sold, we are going to announce it on our email lists and social media that is available for purchase on our website. We're a fairly small tap room and a fairly small brew house, so we anticipate that the vast majority of the beer will sell out online before we even open that day. The hope is that people can drive in, pick it up, and go without having to worry about lines and social distancing. If we can do an automobile pickup, that would be preferable, depending on how it sells online. So I've gotten so many emails from actually around the country that we can't support, but those that are local that want to order it, we're not taking pre-sales. The best thing to do is to sign up for our email list. They will be the first people to find out that it's for sale, and then go online and buy it, and then you can pick it up at any time.
All right. You might see me up there getting some beer. Anything
I hope
else,
we do.
Anything else you'd like to add that we didn't go over?
I think I would just say we are looking to brew this beer again at the end of the year and possibly again in time for the inauguration, depending on how our brew schedule works out. So this won't be the last opportunity to get this beer, but it will be the first opportunity. We also have poster prints of the artwork, which have gotten a lot of great feedback. And we just got stickers in, and we got some T-shirts, and we're getting some glassware. So presidential paraphernalia is certainly a thing, and we don't mind hopping on that bandwagon a little bit.
All right, John, thanks for taking the time to talk to me. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks to Wilmington Brewworks VP John Fusco and R. Nick Schellino for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, and Delaware Public Media's Roman Battalion, Nick Schellino, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsink. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.